and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, as always, Tim Dennis. Tim.
Yeah.
My voice is in that low timbre range again.
Boy, this is never.
We live on only 3 hours of sleep. It's last night was a long night, man. I think I went to bed about 3.5 hours ago. I'm here now. We're getting ready to record Thursday's show. It's been a crazy week. We have some information as well that we want to start off the show with. A friend of ours and a friend of the show is in a unique situation. So, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, a good friend of ours who we interviewed on the second Jericho Cruise, former AEW champion John Moxley, is going through a little bit of a tough time right now. He actually had the courage to pull himself off the road. He's at the top of the card right now in AEW. Pulled himself off the road and entered himself into an inpatient alcohol treatment program. Of course, John and his wife Renee have a brand new baby, and he just felt like now is the time to address the problem and get into treatment and get things taken care of. And we want to, first of all, applaud him for tackling the problem, and second of all, we want to send out our good thoughts, good energy, and our prayers to John to get well soon, and just applaud him for getting after it.
Yeah. So we're calling on all of you, our army of Darkness Radio, to put out good prayers and intentions for John Moxley of AEW to get through this, to give him strength, to be able to stay with this new path and get healthy again.
Yeah.
That's all we can ask. We've seen miracles with these prayer requests before, and we will continue doing so on the show and on our social media. I do want to make a quick mention of that. Folks, I apologize, especially being on the road as much as I've been. I know that I missed some of yours. It doesn't mean I didn't think you were worthy or I didn't want prayers and healing for you. I promise you, it's that I get so many emails every day. I only have so much time every day that I can allot to actually trying to get into my email bank. I try to notice ones that say prayer and healing request. If you, you know, put that right in the regarding line on emails, it might help me a little bit more. But please be patient. If you haven't heard from me or seen us post it within a day, just write me again to get my attention. I do apologize. I know it's tough, and I know so many of you have issues in your life with family, friends, or perhaps even your own life. And you just want a little extra boost and you want those prayers and healing, and we will continue to do them. And I think we still cover about 90 to 95% of them. There's just a few from time to time that slip through the cracks. And Facebook has a weird algorithm. If we're not friends on Facebook, there's like two different spam folders, and they're making them harder and harder with these updates to actually locate when I go in to social media. You guys may not even know that there are two different spam folders in your deal. If you try to access it from your phone, you can't find it. If you go into your emails on your computer through Facebook, you can track it, but it's crazy. So sometimes I never even see these messages till 3, 4, 5 months later. And I do apologize for that. So please, the best way to reach me and have the best chance of being seen is dave@darknessradio.com. And then we'll do what we can to put those prayer and healing requests out there. I will ask you one thing, though, folks. Just this is where it's got to be. It's got to be a prayer and healing request from you, the patient, or an immediate family member of the patient or the person dealing with this. Believe it or not, over the 15, 16 years we've been doing the show, I've had people threaten me with lawsuits because we've posted a prayer and healing request for them. And that was because they didn't want people to know about their private life. A good friend put it up there. A distant relative put it up there. And we posted the prayer request trying to do something good, and it almost led to a lawsuit. So now you have to be like an immediate family member or the person themselves asking for the prayer and healing request, just the way to cover our backside. And we don't post GoFundMes or any of the things begging for money. I understand a lot of people are in hard times here, but we get about 100 of those. At least I do. And I don't know how many Tim gets inundated with, but we get so many. We've just decided we can't post them all, so we don't post any of the GoFundMes. We wish you the best and pray for you and hope that things work out, but we'll put up the prayers for you, but we can't put up the requests for money. Otherwise, we would just be a bulletin board for, you know, every charity under the sun, and we just are at a position where we couldn't do that. So I hope you understand going forward. One of the weirdest phenomena in the paranormal, Tim, that I still, after 16 years of doing this radio show and a lifetime of reading books, still do not fully comprehend nor understand is the poltergeist phenomena.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of that problem comes from the many different interpretations of investigators, researchers, and then, of course, Hollywood throws their version into the mix, which muddles and muddies the waters. And you know that a lot of the quote-unquote researchers out in the field base everything that they know on poltergeist from movies or TV shows. And real legitimate researchers and experiencers that try to share the story sometimes get swept under the carpet. And as I was going through social media the other day, looking at some of the fascinating authors and researchers that are out there, you could see the frustration level in some people that are trying to get the word out, trying to educate people, but maybe do not have the reach of TV shows or radio shows like ours. And they just want to get the real data into people's hands. And I came across Darren Ritson. He has a book that's out right now. Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion is the name of the book. And he has also written a book called The South Shields Poltergeist, One Family's Fight Against an Invisible Intruder. Darren is a researcher. He is somebody that's been in the field experiencing and looking into this. He was born in Newcastle upon Tyne and has had a lifelong interest in ghosts, but more specifically in the poltergeist phenomena itself. And he is known for investigating into the now famous South Shields poltergeist case of 2006, which has been considered, Tim, to be one of the most significant and best attested cases in the last 50 years. And he's spent years traveling around lecturing on poltergeist phenomena. We're lucky enough to have him here. So thank you so much for joining us, Darren.
Hello there. Yes, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. The poltergeist phenomena, the book itself, again, Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion. We have a link for that in our program guide today, folks, so you can find it. Make sure you order it and then rate and review these books to help our authors as well. If you would, talk to us about the South Shields poltergeist case of 2006 and how you came upon this case.
Okay. One day, back in 2006, I was at work at my desk, and a colleague who was my actual line manager at the time came up to me and she said she'd been for a lunch. And after she came back from her lunch, she tapped me on the shoulder and she went, "My friend's daughter's got a ghost." And I turned around and I thought, "Oh, that's interesting. So could he tell us about it, please?" So she proceeded to tell me some information what a friend had been telling her in relation to that. So basically, I got the go-ahead to contact this individual who was Marianne's mother. Marianne is obviously the lady in question who lived at this poltergeist-infested house. And I basically emailed Marianne's mother and started to gather a little bit of information, a little bit of data about what had been going on. And she was telling us about some of the things that she'd experienced at the house. And eventually, I said, "Well, look, can I talk to your daughter about this?" And she said, "Yes." So she gave us her email address, and I contacted her through email, and then I gave her a telephone call. And for the first month or so, I just kept in touch with her and her family, asking about what had been going on, trying to offer what support I could. Although in my mind, from what she was telling me about what was going on, I had an inkling that it could have been like a poltergeist case, but I didn't want to actually see anything there and then. I just wanted to like sort of gather a bit of information. So she said,
now, let me ask you one thing, Darren, if you don't mind. Yeah? You get this call, you hear about this. Now, obviously, you know, as researchers and investigators, we have to take everything kind of with a grain of salt at the beginning. Yeah. Listen to what the story is. Were you getting any kind of red flags or alerts that maybe this person was just hallucinating or making this up, looking for attention? Or could you tell that there was a real sincerity into what they were conveying to you?
Good question. She was, she seemed very sincere when she was telling me what was going on in her house. A lot of the things that she was informing me about seemed to fit classic poltergeist activity. And there's a researcher called Guy Playfair who used to say they've got to get the information right and they've got to know what it is they're reporting if they're going to lie about these things. But all the things she was telling me were, they were like classic poltergeist type incidences, like things being moved. Say, for example, things being found in the bath, which is quite strange. I think your normal aficionado of the paranormal wouldn't really think about tins of beans or something being piled up in geometric patterns in a bath. But she was coming out with some interesting things like that.
So canned food was ending up in her bath?
The worst things appeared in her bath. I'm not sure. I was just using the canned food as an example.
Oh, okay. All right. It's just like, wow, that is weird.
Oh, no. I mean, it does get weird. It was one of the most bewildering things I've ever encountered in my life. But again, on top of that, I thought to myself when she was telling me about these things that were going on, I was also thinking, could I be being taken for a ride here? Because that thought has to cross your mind as well. But for the time being, I basically said, look, if you could start writing down a list, make a diary, what happened, what time it happened, who was there, etc. That would be good. Other advice I sort of give her was, look, in the meanwhile, it might come to nothing. See, she said it had been going on since the December of 2005. And when I first spoke to Marianne, this was June in 2006, so that it had been going for about 6 months already, slowly getting, escalating, you know, like as each day went by, more weird things were like occurring. And I was thinking to myself, because your stereotypical poltergeist normally is short-lived, and investigators are very rarely lucky to get in or to get in at the tail end. I thought to myself, well, it sounds like because it's been going on for like 5-6 months as it is, it's very likely that it could be coming to an end. So I thought, well, we'll give it a bit of time. If things keep on going as they're going, give us a call. I'll keep in touch with you over the next few weeks or so, find out what's going on. And that it basically went from there. Little did we know, when we went in the July of 2006, the thing, it, whatever it is, was just starting to get warmed up. We just went in at the right time. And for another 5 months or so, it was just pandemonium. So I had the impression that, although, yes, you know, it sounds too good to be true, a lot of the stuff she was saying, but I thought, well, in the same respect, these things do happen. So I wasn't going to throw any baby out with any bathwater just yet. I wanted to find out what was going on, and ultimately we wanted to get in and have a little look, see for ourselves. But again, we wanted to wait until the invite came rather than say, we'll come along straight away. So that's how basically that happened. And in the July of 2006, I got a call and it's like, Darren, really, I've had enough of this thing. This is happening, that's happening. Stuff's happening all over. Can you come in and meet me and see what's happening? So we agreed. I basically, at that time, I knew a colleague who'd been round the block a few times in relation to paranormal investigation. He was not a reporter as such, but he was like a freelance journalist, and he wrote columns and he wrote books on the paranormal, and he was a friend of mine. I'd known for a short while. And I thought to myself, well, I'm going to ask this chap if he wants to come along with me for a bit of support. So I phoned him up and said, look, I think I might have a live poltergeist on at the moment, yeah. Would you like to come in? Because I've been invited in to go and see what's happening. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, let's dig into what happened once you got there. But can you help us define, what is a poltergeist? I know the German translation is what, loud, noisy, or knocking ghost. But what exactly is poltergeist phenomena itself?
Poltergeist, well, nobody knows what a poltergeist is, although some folk would beg to differ. A lot of people claim that it's some form of entity coming back to wreak havoc or seek vengeance in some way, an angry spirit. A lot of folks think that it could be a demon coming up, or coming from wherever demons come from, again, to cause misery and mayhem in your life. A lot of folk think that it's the troubled mind of an adolescent being externalized as risk RSPK, which is the recurring spontaneous psychokinesis. There's a number of sort of theories and ideas flying around as to what it might be. But I think nobody actually knows, to be honest, in my opinion, nobody actually knows beyond all doubt exactly what a poltergeist is. To be honest, in mainstream science, and a lot of the top academic researchers are still struggling to prove the actual existence of the activity in the first place. Nobody knows what they are. We know what they do. They do create havoc, and they create absolute pandemonium. They appear in your lives for a short, protracted period of time. They cause havoc. They turn furniture upside down. It's a maelstrom of just psychic activity, if that's what you want to call it. And it's just pandemonium, and it's frightening. And it always seems to be negative. There's always nasty things being done. Sometimes they're big events, again, like the furniture being turned over and doors being slammed closed and stuff like that. Other times it's just little things, little objects being moved around. Makes you question your sanity. Did you put that there? No, I'm sure I left this here. What you know what I mean? No, I never left it there. Right. Sure, you did. No, and it can cause arguments amongst couples as well, saying, you left the door unlocked last night. No, I didn't. I locked that door when I found it open this morning. You know, and just things like that.
It seems that then the term poltergeist, although I'm sure, again, knocking or noisy ghost being the initial kind of explanation for this, it seems that the word poltergeist has now just kind of become a catch-all for like a multitude of different hauntings or psychokinetic energy happening all at once. I know for years there's been, like you were mentioning, the teenage child centered, we find what's called the poltergeist agent, right? The one person that this energy seems to cycle around. Is it emanating from that person, which is then feeding the atmosphere to create, you know, if this person has some psychokinetic energy coming off of them, is it feeding it and allowing ghosts to have enough strength to be seen and heard? You know, there seems to be just this wild, large aspect to all of what exactly is involved in this randomized, almost inexplicable type of paranormal behavior.
Yeah, that's so true. And indeed, the word poltergeist it's actually an old German word. That means obviously the noisy ghost or knocking ghost. I think, to be honest, most people nowadays, well, I mean, you get a lot of people do thinking that it is an angry spirit or an angry ghost. But the likes of Guy Lyon Playfair, who invested the famous Enfield poltergeist, he wrote the foreword to the book, The South Shields Poltergeist, for us. And in his foreword, he actually says something in the lines of, like, well, maybe he's need a new word for it because it's like a redundant word. And I think he's suggesting that there may be another explanation as opposed to being an angry relative coming back from the dead. Even though the Enfield poltergeist case itself, you had Bill Wilkins, who came through the voice of Janet, and as it transpired, there was a guy who lived in the house. So you can say one thing about it and then just be totally overruled by another piece of evidence the next. We keep going round in circles, thinking we're going to get somewhere, and then something rears its head, which contradicts what you've just said. And it's just an absolutely fascinating topic, which, I mean, the Society for Psychical Research was founded in 1882, when the Ghost Club prior to that. They're the two UK's oldest research associations. But prior to that, I mean, poltergeists were being documented way back in the 1600s, 1600s. They go back years and years and years. And to this day, 500, 600, 700 years from whenever the first poltergeist occurred, some say it was even 2,000 years ago, back in the old Roman days. We're still scratching our heads and we're still, you know, in bewilderment as to what these things are. But like I said earlier, when we're talking about trying to work out what they are, there's still people who insist, you know, try proving that they're real in the first place, which to this day, after all this time, it's like Mission Impossible. I mean, there's another book that I own from a 14 Times contributor called S.D. Tucker, and he wrote a book called The Blythe Spirit, and it's all about the history of the poltergeist, and that's a fascinating book in itself. And he suggests maybe we're not meant to know what it is at the end of the day, and he suggests maybe some sort of weird trickster character. I think he sort of likens it to one of the old gods. I think it's is it Loki? He's a bit of a trickster. I think that's what he was saying.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we still haven't got a clue. In my personal opinion, we still haven't got a clue what it is, where it comes from. But there's lots of ideas and theories like going about in this new Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion book. Looks at a different aspect of the poltergeist, the bit where you can actually take some of it home with you. And it just throws a few new ideas into the mix. And ultimately, the idea is, for me personally, is to say, look, here's the book. Get stuck into this. Please take it forward. I think I've done an okay job putting it together. Myself and Mike Halloway, because we're both penned this book actually in 2011 or 2010. It was first published in 2014 under the title Contagion in the Shadow of the South Shields Poltergeist. But years later, I've updated it. I've given it a good going over, and I've changed a lot of stuff, and I've added in lots more new ideas and theories and all the conclusions and things, you know, all the ideas, the questions that I pose, they've all been put in at the back. And the idea is now the clever people can come in and take it away and maybe do something with it. If sure. I can get the ball rolling with this aspect of the poltergeist, then I'll be happy.
Could you explain to us before we go any further, and then I want to get into the case specifically. Again, the new book is called Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion. It's an updated version of your past book with more insights, more information. What do you mean by contagion? When we think of the paranormal, that word never has been really kind of brought into this effect before. Can you give us a little outline and explanation of that?
I certainly can. But before I do that, there is a number of researchers out there in the past that have actually made mention of it. There's not many, but they have. In certain texts and books from the past, which I've managed to uncover, a couple of investigators have actually noted that sometimes it can come home with you. In 1996, for example, John and Anne Spencer from the UK wrote a book called The Poltergeist Phenomenon, and they make mention of contagion events, which I found interesting. And in Guy Playfair's book about the Enfield poltergeist, it's touched upon then. So I was thinking to myself, like quite recently before I did the update, I was thinking, this is an interesting aspect of the poltergeist. Indeed, back at South Shields, myself and Mike and a number of others actually witnessed contagion for ourselves. So again, that got me thinking. This is why we started putting the book together in the first place. But essentially what poltergeist contagion is, it's a process where the phenomena that normally occurs at the primary infested site, or what we would call ground zero, or inverted commas, the haunted house. It seems to spread outwards, and it affects those people that are around it. Say, for example, not immediate family members. The people that live in the house don't suffer from the contagion. It's like other family members, friends who visit the house, for example, or investigators, like we did. They can sometimes take it away with them, and they can experience little bits of poltergeist activity in their house. But the small mercy is, in regards to that, is that those who are infected by it, they don't seem to suffer it to the same degree as what they do at the main haunted house. So it seems as it spreads, it kind of becomes diluted. So say, for example, I visit the house, we have a morning of paranormal activity. This actually happened. We went away to Mike's office, and a big heavy book entitled The Borough of South Shields came flying off the shelf as we walked past the shelf. Oddly enough, we were actually discussing the house itself and what might have been on the land prior to the house being there, or the area, if you know what I mean. So it's a bit of a spooky coincidence that not only did the book fly off the shelf, it happened to be a relevant book discussing like sort of what it is we were thinking about. It's as if it said, there you go, your answers might be in there.
Wow.
And funnily enough, the answers were actually in that book. In this book, it's a 4-pound hardback. It's huge. It's a weighty tome. And it was packed on the shelf with all the other books. You know, like, there's no way it could have just fell off the shelf. It's not the type of pamphlet that would go floating around in a summer breeze, put it that way. And as we walked past it, it just went thump. Both Mike and I jumped and flinched. We looked, we seen this book on the floor. In the first edition of the South Shields Poltergeist book, there's a picture of that book on the floor. And I actually turned around to Mike at this point and I said, Mike, do you think we've brought something back with us? And jokingly, he said, I hope not, because my wife will hit the roof. She'll go mad.
But right.
That's the sort of thing it can do. So I started basically looking around into, you know, like journals and books and things like that. And it ended up on every poltergeist I could find. And I was just looking for instances, potential contagion in other cases. So that, in a nutshell, is what poltergeist contagion is. It can infect you.
So it's almost like when you take a paperclip, which is non-magnetic, and you rub it against a magnet, a strong magnet, and then take it away and then touch it to other paperclips or other metallic things, that paperclip kind of becomes contaminated with that energy and can pass that along.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy, that. In fact, I might use it in another update.
That's fine. I just put in there, thanks to Dave from Darkness Radio. That's all I'm asking. No. So that's an interesting aspect to look at, that this one person or this one location that has this kind of energy might actually leach off onto you. You can pick up it. It starts to affect your own energetic pattern and can create havoc that way. So it can spin off, which is really fascinating, because in most cases, it's always believed that there is one poltergeist agent, one location, or one person that it emanates from.
Yeah.
And when you know, theoretically, if we remove that person, things should quiet down. But if others have been contaminated with this energetic contagion, it could continue to spread, almost like a gosh, what was that old saying, Tim, when a whole bunch of people are supposedly hallucinating the same thing?
Mass hallucination?
Yeah, mass hysteria. You're right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's got that feel to it. That's interesting. And the physiology of our brain and body is such that it is an electronic pattern, right? And if something is upsetting that, could it be redirecting those electronic pathways to allow us A, to see or experience more, or B, to hallucinate, or B, unleashing our own psychokinetic energy, giving us a false sense that it's a haunting when really it's our energetic pattern that's been altered?
Well, again, that's a very good sort of suggestion and a very good idea. And hopefully lots of people who are listening to this or perhaps reading the book when they eventually like get it, I'm hoping that this is what they'll actually do. I hope they'll be stimulated by it and they'll think of this. I hope they find it intriguing or even thought-provoking and say, wow, I would like to take this forward. I think he might be wrong in this respect. I don't think he's right there, but he's, you know, he's made a point here, he's made a point there. And if they can like then take it forward, then in my eyes, that's my job done. To be honest, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a scientist in any way, shape, or form. I've just set the homework, really, if you know what I mean. I've just laid this down. I'm pointing out to the people that, look, this contagion does occur, and I've tried to prove the point that it does occur by citing other cases. Now, in the back of the book, obviously, I've got the bibliography, and it's got all of the journals that I've consulted and all the books that I've used, and the books from, like, D. Scott Rogo, William Rohl, a couple of American researchers, Dr. Barry Taff, who was very kind enough to let me use the chapter from his book to write up his San Pedro case, because there was some fantastic contagion going there. And I've brought together a whole load of other cases and potential contagion instances, which I put them all together in one chapter. And that's one of the new updates of the book, because in the first book, we didn't put that in. I was kind of kicking myself afterwards because in a review, someone had said it would have been good if they could like pull together more cases within it. And I thought, right, well, that's what I'll do for the update. So that's what I did. So
But I want people to realize, though, but you're not a librarian. It's not that you just collected other people's stories and research and put it in this. You are someone who has been out in the field in the midst of these cases. So, folks, if you're looking for this kind of insight and intel, and that's what all of you tell us, is that you want to learn. You want more than just what you see on TV. You want deeper dives into the research and something that's made understandable. This book is easy to understand and follow and to absorb that information. This is also, like you mentioned, a good culmination of pieces from many different researchers coming together to back theories and hypotheses that is giving us a broader, better view of this type of phenomena and contagion. So again, when you pick up the book, Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion, read it, rate and review it. And we do have a link for that book on today's program guide. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break, Darren. When we come back, walk us through this investigation with your partner and what happened. Now that we've given everybody kind of an interesting overview of how you got called to this, given them an overview of what poltergeist phenomena and contagion means, let's find out what the effects look like. We'll do that when we return. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Hey, a lot of cool things coming up here soon, folks. The Las Vegas Para-Unity Convention welcomes the Holzer Files. That's right. Shane Pittman, Cindy Keza, and myself, December 9th through the 11th at the MGM Grand Convention Center, Las Vegas. You can get information at darknessevents.com. So if you've been waiting to get out again and you want to see Vegas, come on out and spend some time with us. Also coming up in February, the Haunted Savannah Paracon. Cindy Keza and myself will be there, along with, I guess Cindy's even going to be doing a large gallery reading there. There's a few other guests that will be joining us. Parapsycon 3 has just been announced May 20th through the 22nd, 2022 at the Ohio State Reformatory, Mansfield Reformatory. We will all be out there. I think there are just two spots left open for our trip to Northern Ireland. Or I'm sorry, not Northern Ireland, it is. I'm sorry, my mind is fluttering about here. Dark Majesties of Northern Ireland with Dave Schrader will be taking place in June 17th through the 25th. There's only one couple spot that remains. And if you are interested in going to Ireland with us and investigating haunted castles, hotels, cemeteries, and more, this is your chance to have an adventure of a lifetime. So make sure that you email me, dave@darknessradio.com. for more information, or just go to darknessevents.com. And I have a lot more events that are going to be popping up on our website as more events are added. I'm getting signed on to quite a few more events. Michigan Paracon just announced they're going to be back, and I'll be a guest with them again next August. I think I've got something coming up almost every month between now and September and October of next year. So if you want to get out and get a chance to meet me, go check out darknessevents.com. And check out all the great and exciting events that are coming your way. Our guest today is Darren Ritson. He is an investigator, researcher, author, and the book is called Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion. You'll find a link for it on today's program guide. All right. Now, Darren, you've heard all these claims over the phone. You've been taking the information in as it comes available. The homeowner or the person afflicted with this issue has finally gotten to the point that they're at their wit's end, and you and your partner decide to go out and investigate this. Talk us through what this investigation looks like and how quickly you start to realize this isn't just somebody misunderstanding normal things, but there is truly paranormal phenomena involved.
Right. Well, that actually happened on day one of our visit. It didn't happen for about 3 or 4 hours. We got there on the day, made our introductions. We were offered a lovely cup of tea, but we refused because the summer of 2006 was a baking hot summer. Well, it was for the UK anyway. We're not very good with the heat over here. So we were like sweltering. So we asked for a glass of water with ice, which was really nice, and it went down well. So basically, interviews were carried out. Mike had sat down with the family and started discussing what was going on, asking all the questions that the pre-investigation interview. He did all that. And I just sort of disappeared upstairs, and I started setting up cameras and little bits and bats to try and see if I could catch anything. So I didn't want to sit there all day with the camera in my bag. I wanted to get the camera set up straight away just to satisfy our curiosity to see if anything was going on. So after about 3 or 4 hours, nothing had happened. We got basically the gist of what had been going on the last few months. I'd already had that information and had it written down, and obviously I discussed it with Mike as well. But for Mike's own peace of mind as well, he went in and he got the story from the family for himself so he could hear what was going on. So 4 hours in, we decided to take a trundle upstairs and see if we could witness anything for ourselves. It had been established that the child's bedroom on the second level of the house seemed to be a sort of area where the poltergeist was quite active. So we decided to go and sit up there and just see if anything happened. And during the next half an hour or so, we were sort of shocked and amazed to see objects flying around the room.
Wait a minute. You saw things just launching across the room?
We saw, imagine a child's plastic toy workbench. He had a little plastic toy, and on it there was a plastic hammer and screwdrivers. And it came with these little nuts and bolts, and there was nuts and bolts strewn out all over the place. Whilst we were in the room talking, discussing things, out of the corner of our eye, we saw this nut, this little yellow plastic nut, whiz across the room. I mean, it happened within a fraction of a second, so fast, and it pinged off the wall, and it bounced back off the wall, and it hit Marianne on her backside so hard that she actually jumped and winced. You know, she like holding that sort of a butt cheek. And me and Mike looked at each other, and, you know, almost immediately we thought, well, whoa, where did that come from? Nobody could have thrown that, because I had my eyes on Mike. Mike had his eyes on the couple. I was watching the couple as well. Everybody was watching everybody, just in case something like this occurred. Because obviously, when people make claims of this sort of nature, the first thing you've got to think about is, oh, we're being taken for a ride here. So we had our eyes on them. I was, you know, everybody was watching everybody. And this thing hit the wall, and it pinged, it ricocheted off the wall, and it made such a noise, and then it bounced back and it hit her. So we got excited about that. And as we were getting excited about that, trying to discuss, well, where that could have came from then, and this is what it was. And, we took a photograph of it on the ground in situ after it had landed. And as we were discussing this, there was a toy, a goalpost, which was about 4 or 5 inches long by 3 or 4 inches in height. It was just lying on the bench. And all of a sudden, we heard it slide across the table, and then it clattered into the bin, which was underneath. And again, there was nobody standing around that area. We never actually saw the things beginning to move at this point, but we caught it as it was falling into the bin. And as you can imagine, we were getting all excited. Obviously, Mark and Marianne, the couple that lived there, they were all stressed out and angry. So we had to apologize. Really, we had to say, look, we're really sorry for getting excited and being happy about this, but from our perspective, it kind of puts you in the clear here. We know now that you're not lying, you're not taking the mick, do you know what taking the mick means in America?
No.
You're not winding us up, sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
So we got kind of excited about that. And there was a whole host of things that occurred that afternoon, which convinced us by the time we had left that there was something definitely untoward going on, but we just didn't know what it was. So we were thinking, well, if we've seen this stuff happening, we've heard things moving. There was a ball that just appeared on the bed. Mark was sitting on the bed, and he was just like, you know, just having to sit down, having a rest. And all of a sudden he jumped up from nowhere, and there was this red ball on the bed, which had appeared next to him. And when we picked the ball up, it was quite actually, it was hot. which was kind of odd as well. But obviously we'd known about objects like that, objects that are touched and that are being thrown around. Sometimes you do find that these objects are hot. So we picked it up to see if it was hot, and it was actually really, really hot. And that had appeared next to him, and he was quite shaken up. And so, I mean, there was a whole host of things that happened that day. But as the investigation progressed...
Now, Darren, let me ask you a quick question before we go on with the progression of the investigation. And I want to talk a little bit about the goalposts that have moved a little bit. And now, here in America, when we see poltergeist videos, the first thing, especially like on YouTube, first thing that'll come up, especially when it comes to something moving, somebody will say, oh, somebody used fishing line, or they use something like that to make something move, or somebody's off camera making something like that move. Did you ever suspect at any time that you said that they weren't on the mic, or they weren't on the take, or you didn't suspect that any foul play was being done behind your back? But did anything like that ever occur to you, that maybe something like that was being used at the time, like fishing line or anything like that, was being used to move anything?
Yeah, we checked for all that.
Okay.
We checked for that. We thought about the trajectory and the speed of the little plastic nut. Where it seemed to come from was the opposite end of where Mark and Marianne were standing. All this was discussed after we went home. We were racking our brains. We were convinced, don't get me wrong, but in the back of our mind, we were thinking, how could this have been faked if it hadn't been faked? You know? And
well, can I ask you, too, following up on that real quickly? I mean, to hear claims... To you know, hear somebody that's sharing what they've gone through, as a good investigator, there has to remain a high level of skepticism. Indeed. Because people do make mistakes. But for God's sakes, Darren, you're there. You see this now taking place. Mm-hmm. What is that like? Because a lot of our listeners have never seen this. We've never experienced that type of activity in our own lives, just what Hollywood shows us. What is it like to actually be there in the thick of this?
Oh, that is a... How do you put that into words? I was excited, happy, bewildered, completely bewildered. It was like, what on earth? It's like, goodness me. Potentially, these people are telling the truth, and we could have a live poltergeist on our hands at this case. We were a little disappointed in the respect that it had been going on for about 6 months. So we were saying, well, you know, if we've got a live poltergeist here, then it's likely that it's going to be drawn to a close soon. We've just managed to get in at the tail end. But as it transpired, it didn't. For the next 5 months or so, we were threat to, well, say we were threat, the family... They were continually putting up with this. I mean, it got to a point eventually where they were actually bored of it. They were bored, they were fed up, they were sick. And after a while, it just became everyday normality for them. It's as if they'd lost all that fear, but they knew we were there to help as well. We were just at the end of a phone call or in a taxi ride down the road, we would come. If they needed, we would be there. So at least they had like a shoulder, or they had a little bit of support. They weren't on their own. But it was absolutely fascinating. I never dreamed in a million years that I would see poltergeist activity displayed on the level that I saw at that house in 2006. And that ranges from objects appearing in midair in the corner of the room and then just dropping to the floor. We had coins. There was two investigators from... There's a research society in the UK called the Association for ASAP, the Association for the Scientific. You know what it is?
I'm trying to think of the full name of it too, but I know what you're getting.
The Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. That's it.
There we ASAP. Go. Okay.
the chairman at the time. It was a friend of mine. I gave him a call and I said, again, this was late into the case. I said, look, do you want to come up and bring your wife, his wife was on the committee at the time as well. And I'd done an investigation or two with him, with ASAP. And he came up with his wife. And on that particular day, he experienced the same sort of things. Only this time there was like coins raining down from nowhere in a room that was like sort of all closed. You know, that we were sitting around the table in the kitchen, and there was coins just batting off the floor and landing and just clattering everywhere. So we witnessed a whole host of bewildering, striking, fantastic paranormal phenomena. But Mark and Marianne, like I said earlier, they were getting to a point where a coin would land, they would just pick it up, dead calm and cool, and just put it on the table and then get on with their lives, because it had been going on for that long for them.
When a coin comes through, are you looking at the dates? Is there any significance to the type of things that are reporting?
No. These coins were just 5 pences, 2 pences, 1 pences, 1 pence pieces, just spendable money. We never worked out where the money was coming from, but it was just normal coins. There is a case which occurred in the late 80s, early 90s in Cardiff in England, where the investigators asked for coins, because coins seems to be a regular thing with poltergeists. It seems
right.
They seem to be obsessed with coins and money. In the Cardiff poltergeist case, which was investigated by Professor David Fontana, right, the late Professor David Fontana, they were asking for coins. And then there was these old coins from like 1912, which were appearing. You know, like they're bigger than the normal 1p coin. They're about the size of about an inch in diameter, if you know what I mean. An inch in diameter round. They were appearing. But then there's other cases where coins just drop out of midair, and they just scatter on the floor. Eventually, at the end of the day, we gathered up all these coins, and there was a pile of coins on the table, which this poltergeist had seemingly deposited from nowhere. I mean, I stood there open-mouthed most of the time, just absolutely fascinated. But it got to a point where it started sending text messages and threats as well to the landline.
Wait. Text messages? Where were the messages coming from? There has to be an origination point for those.
Yeah, there was. Mark had a phone, and Marianne had a mobile phone as well, but they also had a house phone, which was incoming calls only. I don't think they could, they weren't allowed to ring out, which obviously helped saves on bills and things like that. But we established that a lot of the text messages that were being sent to Marianne, these were like terrifying death threats and horrible threats. That seemed to be coming from Mark's phone. So what we did, obviously we asked him about it, and he strenuously denied it. So we took the phone off him, and Mike had the idea of dismantling it. And he put the SIM card out on the table, and he put the battery on the table. And everybody put their mobile phones on the table. Even the investigators put them down. And we were busy having a conversation, just in general. I'd forgotten about it. And Marianne's phone buzzed, bzz, message coming through. She picked it up. And it was another message, hello, or hi, something in the lines of that. And it's come from Mark's phone. And it's, well, his phone's sitting on the table here with the battery out, with the SIM card out. So it shouldn't be working at all. But somehow the poltergeist managed to send the text messages. It was sending them to the house phone at first. And now back in the day, this was like 15 years ago, obviously the technology isn't what it's like now. It was a little bit different then. Back in the day, when you got a message on your landline, you'd have to ring the number, and you'd get this like electronic automated voice that would talk in a robotic style, and it would relay your message. And she got a few of them. She picked up the phone, and it said hi, hello, that type of thing. And she lost her temper, and she actually just shouted out into the atmosphere. She went, "Will you stop it? Will you leave this alone?" A few expletives in there as well, a few choice words. You went, "Just leave her alone, we've had enough." The phone went, tring, tring, tring. Message came through, "I'm sorry." So we were like, goodness me. I mean, it was actually like sort of partaking. It knew what she was saying. It was like as if it was apologizing to what she had said. So the thought of pre-programming a phone to send a text at a later time, if that was going to be the case, whoever pre-programmed the phone would have had to have known what she was going to say, if you know what I mean. But at the end of the day, the SIM card was out and the battery was out, so the phone should never have worked in a million years anyway, but it did. And then it just went from there. I mean, the guy, Mark, also got cut. It actually physically attacked him on 5 occasions. The first occasion, unfortunately, I wasn't there. I was at home asleep. Mate got called out in the middle of the night. got a taxi down. Now, here's another example where it sort of deposited money. Mike got to the house, they were sitting around the table. Mark had already been cut. He got out of bed, his body was burning, and it's just cut him to pieces. He was bleeding all over the place. Absolutely terrified. Mike got called out. When they're sitting around the table, Marianne had said, "Listen, Mike, thank you for coming down. We really must reimburse you for your taxi money." Mike, as usual, insisted, "No, I won't take any, you know, we're here to help. We don't want your money." And out of the blue, this crumpled up 10-pound note just appeared and hit him in the forehead and dropped down onto the table. I mean, it's fascinating. It does sound too good to be true, and it does sound...
Well, first of all, I just want you to know that going forward, any poltergeist willing to just throw money around, you can send them right to America, to my house, or maybe maybe send them right over to Tim's house over at 314. Herod, Tim, where are you?
I'm here. Yeah.
Stop me? Oh, this time you're going to allow me to say the address. Well, I'm not going to, Tim, now that I know it's all about the money. Darren, that's crazy.
It is the entire investigation from the moment we set foot in the house till the October of 2006. It was absolutely a crazy roller coaster of a ride. It seemed this poltergeist seemed to have intelligence. It knew where they were going. It knew what they were doing. It eavesdropped in on conversations and sent text messages to coincide with the conversation. On one occasion, Marianne and Mark had had enough, and they thought, right, I'm going to my mum's for tonight, my mother's house. So they cut some stuff together, and they left. And then Marianne had phoned Mike. She says, look, if your phone is at the house tonight, I'm not going to be there. I'm going to my mum's. We've had enough. We just want one night away from it. Please tell me it won't follow me. Okay? Second later, a nanosecond later, in a blink of an eye, text message came through. Oh, I've got a text, Mike. I'm just going to check it. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. She started, like, getting really, really upset and panicky. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It sent us a text. It says, I will come with you to your mom's. I will follow you. Basically, that's what it said. Jeez. And then she had turned around to Mike and said, Mike, it's following us. To me, Mike, please tell us that I'm going to be safe tonight. It's not, it's going to get us. It's going to get us. Bang. Another text comes through instantaneously. I will come with you, bitch. I will kill you when you are asleep. You know, that sort of stuff. That's what
Jesus.
It was.
Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there ever a visual representation of a spirit? Did you guys ever, or did they ever see something human or inhuman?
Yeah, not so much inhuman, but there was there was a number of apparitions, accompanying apparitions, shall we say, that appeared in the house throughout the course of the investigation. In the early stages, the young child, Robert, who we've named in the book, he had an imaginary friend called Sammy, who we used to play with. And Sammy seemed to materialize in different forms. On one occasion, he saw an old man, you know, like a figure of an old man. On another occasion, he was like the youngster, but he had like weird bubbly blue skin, which is what he reported. On another occasion, it was on the night that Mike was called out, actually, after Mark had been cut for the first time. They were checking the house over, and as they were walking around the house, for the benefit of the tape, you know, this is moved, right, we'll check the next room, but they were doing the rounds in the house, and then all of a sudden, the two of them looked towards the top of the landing stairs, and they both saw this black, human-shaped shadow just silently walked past. But as it walked past, it kind of turned, and according to Mike, it sort of stared at him with these like eerily icy eyes. Even though he couldn't see facial features, he knew it was just staring at him momentarily, and then it continued walking into the bedroom. When they went into the bedroom, there was nothing there. And this was actually being recorded at the time on an EVP machine, shall we say. It was like a voice recorder. And you can hear it unfolding as it goes on, and it's quite harrowing, actually. It is actually quite harrowing. So when Mike had turned around and said, I've just seen this, I've just seen that, and then you can hear Marianne in the background sort of like, yeah, I've seen it as well. But one of the most spine-chilling recordings I think we've sort of got. It's not so much phenomena in itself, it's reaction to it. Because when Mike had opened the door, he actually turned around and said something in the lines of, "Great, was your bed in the middle of the room before?" And you could hear Marianne say, "No." And Mike went, "Well, it is now." She walks into the room. "Oh my God, oh my God." And you can hear the fear in her voice. "Oh my God, it's moved. Everything's moved." The whole room had been turned upside down. But seconds earlier, they'd been in and it was immaculate. Somehow, and this happened on a number of occasions, somehow within a few seconds, the whole room was trashed, but it was trashed silently. You didn't hear bang, clatter, you know, bang, bang, bang. 1 minute it was perfect, next minute upside down, and had done it in the blink of an eye. So again, well, left scratching my head. I mean, and I wasn't there that night, unfortunately. But on other nights, when I was there, similar things happened. I've seen doors moving, doors being closed. I had a game of, it wasn't a game. I was trying to get to sleep on the settee one early morning, and it wouldn't let us go to sleep. It engaged me in a game of blanket tug of war. I was pulling the thing off us, and I was literally trying to pull it back onto us and stuff like that. Again, on another one of the occasions when Mog was attacked, there was about 9 or 10 of us in the room, and we all had video cameras trained on it. And he got cut. He was feeling the red, and I'm burning up. Off came his top, and it was like something out of a slasher movie. Welts appeared and it started bleeding. But that, on top of everything else, you know, you could have a rational explanation maybe for the cuts in some way. You could have some sort of an allergic reaction to someone or to something. In fact, someone actually did turn round and say, this is crazy, this. Perhaps without you seeing, he pulled out a slice of bread and rubbed it all over his body, you know, which then turned brought out because he might have had a gluten allergy. So rubbing bread on his body in front of about 10 people that just happened and not see it was just ridiculously silly. We know he didn't rub bread on himself. I mean, I know that sounds mad, but that accusation was leveled at us. And there's some crazy accusations being led at us. But I'm trying to think of it from their perspective as well. If that was me listening to somebody else's story, I'd be thinking, well, goodness me. It does sound too hard to believe. But luckily, we've got lots of footage. We've got lots of recorded evidence and photographs. And it's being analysed and examined as we speak for the second time. Now, with this footage, you've got to be really careful because it identifies the family. And from the very word go, from the minute we stepped in, we don't want to be identified. We want this done, dusted. We want this finished. We want to get on with our life. We're not interested in media. We're not interested in publicity. We don't want anybody to know who we are. So for 15 years, we've kept that promise. And until the day I die, I will not tell anybody who this family is. But this family do exist. But in order to get this footage analysed, some of the footage had to go across and some names had to be sort of disclosed. But they were disclosed after waivers were signed, and it's took us all this time to decide who can look at the footage, who can't. And the individual who's looking at the footage is a very respected parapsychologist in the USA, actually. Him and he's got like a team of researchers and writers that write for like scientific journals. He's actually called James Horan. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of him. He's been looking at the footage with another parapsychologist called Cindy Little. And I trust them with that information. They've got reputations. They are professional sort of people. So I know all that information. And this is what the information we gathered was for. It was never meant to go on documentaries and make us money. It's not meant for that.
Right.
It's meant for.
What are the initial findings? I mean, what do they think of this type of phenomena that you're sharing with them?
Well, that remains to be seen because the paper that's been prepared, which I've somehow managed to get my name on the paper, and they said, "Well, you've provided the information. I've provided lots of stuff." They said, "Look, we'll do this paper together as a little group." It's basically James and Cindy who are looking at this, and what they're doing is they're taking the evidence and they're taking the data and they're analysing it and they're looking at it and they're comparing it with other cases. So this journal paper is going to be a big paper on how our case evidence sort of ties in with all the rest. They're looking at the big picture, if you know what I mean. But in 2000 and in the early days of the infestation, after the book had come out, there's a guy from the UK Society for Psychical Research called Alan Murdy. He took some of the footage away because in his mind, he was thinking, well, they've made some extraordinary claims here in the book. So if they've made these claims, surely they're going to have a little bit of evidence to like support what we've said. So he came up and he interviewed Mike and I all day and we gave him loads of stuff to take away. And in his final report, when he reviewed the book for the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, he actually said, look, you know, these people are telling the truth. I've seen evidence which backs up what they've said. There's lots of different evidence. Yeah, there's some interesting evidence there. This is interesting in that respect. You know, he's looking at like the data on the photographs and the film, you know, like the EXIF data, which you take on a digital photograph. It's got times and things like that. It all ties in. So he was quite happy and satisfied that we were telling the truth. And I was like, well, that's fair enough, but we knew we were telling the truth. But it's absolutely fascinating. To this day, 15 years on, I still do pinch myself and I think, wow. Because up until that point, I'd only read about Guy Playfair's Enfield Poltergeist. I'd only heard about these people, the likes of Colin Wilson and Guy Playfair. But after this case came about, and after we got Guy Playfair to write the foreword, we got invited down to London. We did a talk for the SPR. We showed a little bit of footage, what we could. Some footage you can show, other footage you can't, et cetera, et cetera. And we got to meet all these people. And all these people now know what we've did. And I still think 15 years on.
That's crazy.
It's just so surreal. I sometimes can't believe it myself. And it happened to me.
Now, let me ask you, is there a place, I know listeners are going to be beating me up if I don't ask this, is there a website, is there a place they can see some of this footage, photographs, anything like that, so that they can see it for themselves, or is this still just in the hands of researchers that are doing papers and trying to, you know, analyze what's going on with all of it?
Yeah, that's just, in a nutshell, that's what it is. It's just, in the early days, there was talk of a couple of documentaries, but we were dubious about it. But then my publisher was saying it'll be good for sales, good for this, good for that. But we then had to like sort of be selective of what footage we could use because a lot of the footage, the family are identified on it. So there's a lot of the footage. It's a bit of a touchy subject. It's created a lot of hostile debate because a lot of people then claim we haven't actually got any footage because
we're not putting
it out there. But the reason we're not putting it out there is simply because we're trying to protect the anonymity of the family.
Nobody's can't they blur that and just, you know, swirl out the faces or black out the faces, things like that, so that you can't identify who the people are specifically, but show the phenomena either way?
Yeah, we can. We can. But we've also been told if you can blur out faces and you can edit footage, what else can you manipulate?
Right.
Either way, we can't win. We can't win. So what we've had to do is we've had to keep the footage raw. We've had to keep it real.
Right.
And we've only had to give it to people who we trust implicitly.
These
people can testify that this footage does exist. It's terribly unfortunate. But I would much rather 1 million people tell me, you're lying, you're fake, you're making this up. I can live with that because I know it wasn't. The prime objective here always was to help the family through it.
Sure.
And then protect the anonymity afterwards so they can get on with their lives.
Right. Here's something I'll mention to you, though, just to, you know, if this eases any of your doubts. First of all, I appreciate the compassion that you're showing for this family. I appreciate the way that you are protecting the footage and the evidence, but standing behind it. But in you know, the state of, well, if you can blur faces, you can fake evidence. Listen, in today's society, most people at home with a good computer and software can make things look paranormal. So yeah. There's going to be detractors no matter what. I think getting your research and evidence out there is, paramount. Believers are going to believe, haters are going to hate, but yeah. giving other researchers and people a chance to hear a steady voice, somebody that's showing real footage, even if the faces are blurred out, you could have actors standing in there and fake things. It doesn't matter. I think if you allow that to be seen and blur out the family members so at least people can see what this type of phenomenon is, just think of this. You're going to be helping people all around the world that are going through this and feel isolated, alone, and like nobody will believe them. Now they might be able to point to your documentary, your book, and say, this is what's happening. This yeah. is what's in my life. So I hope that you'll take that into consideration as well going forward, because it's a shame to have to sit on that for fear that it's, either way, you're being looked at as a fraud. People don't believe you have the footage, or if you show the footage, people are going to think that you're a fraud because it's obviously faked in their opinion. But it's going to go the same way, but at least get the information out there.
Yeah. Even if we release the footage anyway,
right.
With faces on, just say the family decide, right, we want to do this. And it goes out there. So it's still going to be accused of being fake anyway.
Oh, of course. Right. So stop worrying. Yeah. Stop worrying and just put it out there and let the general public see it. That you're going to help more people that are in dire straits dealing with this, making them realize that they are not alone. They're not mental. They're not, defective, that this happens. And here's proof. Other people have seen this. I think that will go a long way in helping a much broader audience, which it seems like with your integrity, that's really what you want to do, is get answers and help people and show this phenomenon for itself. So just something to consider.
Well, it's something that I've constantly thought about for a long time anyway. I'm always wrestling with what I've got sitting up in my cupboard up there. They're still on little tapes. None of it's been sort of moved on digitally. The tapes are sitting up in the top of my cupboard in a couple of boxes put away. And I'm always sitting looking at it, i.e. thinking to myself, oh my goodness, I wish.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like a constant battle that I'm having with myself as well. But then again, I'm thinking like, well, I promised to protect the family and I promise to do this, and even if I did release it, then it's going to get slated anyway. And who's going to be? So in my way of thinking, I was thinking, well, I'll give it to some parapsychologists who I can trust. Mm-hmm. And then at least they've seen it. Then they've wrote a report on it. And if anybody was to ever say, well, no, they don't have the footage in the first place. Well, I can say, well, actually it's been examined twice for the psychical research. So it does exist. So who knows, maybe one day the footage will be allowed to be released. Maybe one day I might decide to do that. But then,
I understand.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's like,
but you know what? Here's the thing.
Do for the best. And I can understand everybody's frustration. People
are going to question your integrity no matter what you do. And I realized, helping TV shows like Ghost Adventures and Paranormal State and Haunted Hospitals and being on the Holzer Files myself and now on a new program that I'm working on, you're not going to please everyone. What you do is you put forth the best effort, the best work that you can possibly do, and just allow people to make their own decisions. And I've realized from the start, I'm not doing this for anybody but myself. I'm doing it for the opportunity to see things, experience things, and be a part of history. And I'll take you along on that journey with me. It's your decision to decide if you want to believe or not. I don't have to force that on you. And I think if you adapt and kind of adopt that principle as well, it'll help you ease your mind. Because I've got people calling out my integrity for being on a ghost show. I've got people for doing that stuff. And I'm like, you know what, though? You're watching, and maybe it'll at least open up a dialogue and make you think and make you consider other possibilities. And that's all you can do. You've got to just let go and have faith that the work you do, as long as you believe that you're doing the work and that you're putting the heart into it, and it's not a sellout, then I think you should be, more than proud of the work that you've got. And here's the thing. If you find out at some point in the future that there was some kind of chicanery going on, some kind of shenanigans, you can always re-release and denounce it and say, ah, the answer is finally here. It was faked. It was fraud. We found out because of this. There's, you know, there's many ways to look at these aspects, but the debate of should you release or not release, we've got that out there now. But so talk to us about how long from start to finish in your investigation, how long did that take place?
Our personal investigation, we came in on the first house visit was July of 2006 till October of 2006. But throughout the June of 2006, leading up to the first visit, that was like a month's worth of just phone calls and checking in, that sort of stuff. But from the moment we stepped into the house in the July, it ran all the way till the October. So that was July, August, September, October. It was about 4 or 5 months for us. But before we got in, it started in December of the 2005.
So in this case, what exactly do we do for a poltergeist case? You know, if it's a haunting, if it's a demonic infestation, you know, a lot of times prayer, priests, reverends, rabbis, you know, religious leaders can step in and be of an aid. But when it's a poltergeist activity where we can't exactly pinpoint the origin of where it's stemming from, how do you go about helping them? Is it simply by giving them the acknowledgement that they're not crazy, that this is real? Does that help them enough until this thing finally dissolves? Which, you know, according to like Dr. Barry Taff and William Roll, it seems that most poltergeist cases are a short roll. They might be anywhere from a month to 4 or 5 months, and then they just kind of burn out.
Yeah. That's what we were thinking from the outset as well. So as we went in, we were saying, well, it's been going on for X amount of months anyway. So it's very likely we've come in at the tail end and it's going to finish soon. And we kept on saying that. I would think it's going to finish soon. It surely can't go on much longer than this. And as we were going on, it was getting more intense and it was getting more frightening. And at one point, I was even thinking to myself, goodness me, when is this thing ever going to finish? We thought to myself, this is like an absolutely like way longer than what the usual pull again. I mean, you get exceptions to the rule. And for 14 months, ours was about 11 months, you know, almost a year, shall we say. There's other cases that lasted a couple of years. But 9 times out of 10, the investigators just get in just as it's finishing. Just when people realize something's actually going on in the first place, that's when it's beginning to end. And this is why a lot of investigators are so frustrated because I think that's why they're so happy with this recent poltergeist case. I say recent, I mean, it was 15 years ago, but you know, it was like this was a case where the investigators managed to get in and record a lot of the information and a lot of the phenomena that was going on there, i.e., you know, in notes, in a book, you know, on tape, recordings and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Well, and the anxiety of the family living through this situation can sometimes also feed that, and it might make it go longer. If this family's feeling frazzled, stressed, at their wit's end, they're putting off a chaotic energy, which could also continue some of this a little longer than it normally would, depending on the chemical balance or imbalance in them as well, dealing with this. Well, how did this finally come to a conclusion? Was it a slow fade of activity, or did it just, it was there one day, gone the next?
Well, funny enough, you're talking about the fear that it lived. That's touched upon in the new book. Actually, I talk about different ideas and theories and what the poltergeist is. And it seemed to be able to feed off the fear. And the more it did things, the more it moved things and overturned things. It was engineered. And there was a lot of things that were engineered, perfectly timed, like the texts and things like that. There was a point in the investigation where there was a lull for about 3 or 4 days. Now, Mariana turned around and she started to feel a little bit upbeat, thinking, oh my God, this is actually finished. She was starting to feel happy about things. And just as she was starting to feel happy and just as she was starting to think that this may be it, it's actually finished, she got a text. And all the text said was, I'm back. And that was it. And I'm going goosebumpy thinking about it, because at that particular moment, you can imagine the fear and dread that would have just rushed back into her. And it tamed things to perfection, this thing. Now, this is why I'm torn. I don't know what on earth a poltergeist is. it seems to be, in this occasion, it seemed to have some sort of malevolent sentience. It was
an intelligence.
Indeed, it had intelligence and it knew how to frighten people. In the conclusion we come to in the new Contagion book is, why would a poltergeist do stupid little things like move a tin of beans, or you know all different range of types of activity, from the little movement of an object to a big movement of an object, or a door slamming, or objects appearing in the air. Every little thing that it does, we think, could be engineered that way. Because even the slightest little object moving, it maybe it's not being frightening, but it's like, it's disconcerting, and it gets you thinking. It can get under your skin, and it can get into your head. And we suggest that all this sort of fear and anxiety and stress that it does, it sort of precipitate, you know, within the focuses of the family, could potentially feed off that. I mean, it's not our theory per se. Other people have said it before, but then we've looked at it and we thought, well, in this case, this seems to be the case. So why would it be doing all these things? In the conclusion, to instill terrifying fear into the family so it can continue to feed. And this is one of the reasons what we think, well, why would it then infect other people? Why would other people go away and experience stuff in their own house? And it makes sense that the more people it can infect, the more people will get frightened, the more it can feed. So in a nutshell, why does a poltergeist potentially precipitate contagion? Simple, its desire to survive. That's if it is indeed some sort of intelligent, sentient being. But then that's just one argument.
Right. Now, after this threat that, hey, I'm back, where did it go from there? Did it continue in different ways?
Yeah. It just went on as per normal. It did that a lot. It disappeared for a few days and then it just come back. And it always seemed to tame its intrusions. It's re-entered the situation, re-entered the house. Just at points where they were beginning to feel upbeat again. And it got to a point, it was just like, oh my God, this thing's never going to go away. It's going to stay forever. And we were saying, look, we are 100% convinced it's a classic poltergeist. If you look at poltergeist sort of literature, look how they work. Look at the repertoire of things, you know, the tricks that they've got. They go through these patterns and then they finish. Some are longer than others. You've been incredibly unfortunate here. You've got a relatively intense, long poltergeist infestation here, but it will finish. But then a senior sort of lecturer at Sunderland University gave us a bit of a tip, and he was asking about dormant electricity in the house, and he had this notion that perhaps they feed on, not only do they feed on fear, perhaps maybe they might feed on electricity, which is another sort of theory in itself. So he said maybe turn off all the, you know, all your devices, you know, like your stereo, your TV. So don't leave them standby because it might be feeding off them. Now, I don't know if it was psychosomatic or if it was, you know, like placebo effect. When we told the family to do this, it seemed to then just come to an abrupt standstill, this poltergeist. It seemed to work. However, the thought occurs, because it had been going on for almost a year, perhaps it was just coincidence that just as we went in and said, turn all the electric off and don't give it anything to feed on, it can't feed on your fear anymore because you're more or less sick to death of it. So it maybe it's feeding up, you know. So cut its other food supply off. I mean, this is all hypothetical, of course, you know. I mean, we're still blundering around in the dark ourselves. We don't know the answers. This is just a hypothetical theory. But they turned it off and it seemed to come to an end. It finished. At least it did at the house for a protracted period of time. It then went away with them and started playing havoc in their work, that place of work as well, which is that, yes, there's a new chapter in the updated version of the South Shields poltergeist, which we omitted from the first one, if you know what I mean. There was reasons why they didn't want that work put in there, because if they found out who they were, blah, 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 they might have thought they might have interfered with their jobs, and they didn't want that. So we kept the chapter out, and then we put it in the later one. But it's hard work. It fries your brain thinking about these things. But there's all these ideas and theories which we've put down on paper, and we've said, think about this, think about that. Could it be this? Could it be that? Having said that, you know, William Rowe said this. D. Scott Rogo says that. He was the first to mention this. Barry Taff said that. Put it all together. What we got? We don't know what we've got. Go away and argue about it. Go away and discuss contagion. We don't know this. We don't know that. We don't know its nature. But there's one thing we do know, and that's the poltergeist is real, and it can spread like an insidious disease.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's the way, that's basically where the book ends. That I've just spoiled the end.
Well, no, that's fine. There's so much more meat to this book, folks.
There's
but
so
that's
much
giving
more
you an
between,
insight.
Yeah, really, yeah.
And as this continues to grow and, you know, people are becoming more aware of it, and even science is starting to examine different phenomena a little differently. And, you know, is there a way to start to measure these expenditures of energy? You know, I think because we do have people like you out there still researching, bringing evidence to cyclical research and science to give them a chance to examine it, to break it down for themselves. That's how we're going to start to break down these walls. And that's how it's going to help others that are dealing with the similar phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, either way, whether my work gets accepted or whether it just gets thrown by the wayside, as long as it's read, it can be looked at, and it could, some people right. might find it interesting and move it forward. Other people might disagree. They might eventually, so many years down the line, they might get to the conclusion of what a poltergeist really is or where it comes right. from. And everything I've done might mean nothing, but at least I can say, well, I had a go. I've had a bit to think about it myself. I've had a try.
And you've created a dialogue. Yeah, you've created a dialogue to a lot of people.
Started, especially in relation to the. I don't know why in the past no one's ever really thought, hang on, after I brought some home with me, this is an interesting aspect of, because there's lots of different aspects of the poltergeist, and lots of, you know, there's little things, it's got little arms and legs here, then everywhere, little, you know, things that it does. And this is one aspect of poltergeistry, if poltergeistry is indeed a word.
I like it.
It's kind of caught my eye. Yeah. And it's like, well, I'd heard about it before South Shields. We experienced it at South Shields, like the contagion aspect. And it was like, yeah, this has got me sort of hooked this. So when we did the first book, and then foolishly, I didn't put loads of... See, the book sort of follows on from South Shields. We got other cases. We went to other houses. We had other... And we noticed parallels within the cases in other examples of contagion. And that's where we got sort of the idea from. We sort of, we need to document this as well. So a lot of the book, the first part of the book was like post South Shields, what happened to us after South Shields, other investigations. There's a number of investigations we went to where it just seems like lots of different things happened. Everything seemed to point towards it being one great entity. Like maybe there isn't hundreds and thousands of poltergeists dotted around all over the world at different times.
Right.
Maybe every poltergeist that's ever been, that ever was, that ever is part of one sort of
collective.
It's being sort of manipulated by a parent mm-hmm. body, and it's got little. Each and every poltergeist that's out there could be part of the greater thing, and it's all us, you know. And if there's one greater poltergeist, you know, they call it an arc poltergeist or some sort of cosmic thing. This parent body thing, it's going to have traits and idiosyncrasies and things like that. And if it's putting out other poltergeists here, there, and everywhere, of course, all the idiosyncrasies and all, they're all going to be the same. And that could maybe explain why all poltergeists go through this repertoire of doing the same thing. Because even back in the day, back before there was internet, telephones, and all sorts, we find out that a poltergeist that threw rocks in Australia and moved certain things and liked to do certain things also happened in the UK. So why would a poltergeist on one side of the world do the exact same thing as another one on the other side of the world when these people from both ends of the world don't even know that these other places exist? The reports right. come in. When you look at these other reports from cases going all the way back, you find all these striking similarities. And it's just a thought. It's just an idea. Because in our poltergeist has never been sort of suggested before. Perhaps it's just one, and it's just orchestrating everything else. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? But...
No, it opens up It opens up a new dialogue. I do wonder, though, Darren, so you and Michael are invested in this for 4 or 5 months, hands-on, boots on the ground. What about the contagion factor for the two of you? Did you go home having phenomena take place around you because you were so steeped in it?
Well, yeah, we think we did. We had the incident with the Borough of South Shields, the big hardback book. We were convinced that something had occurred in Mike's office as we walked out, you know, the book that flew off the shelf. And there was other instances. There was a fascinating incident quite early on in the case, actually, where 2 o'clock one morning, Mike's telephone rang, his mobile. He tried to rush and get it, pick it up, but he missed the call. And he looked at the screen and it said, missed call, Danny. That was his friend. So he never thought anything of it. Went back to sleep, woke up the following morning, phoned up his friend, Danny. He said, hello, Danny. You rang last night, 2 o'clock in the morning. Danny. No, I never rang you, Mike. I never. Since you did, I've, it's on my screen, yeah. You rang us at 2 o'clock. No, I didn't. Yes, I did. So they thought nothing of it. Anyway, later in the day, Danny had visited. He had to go and visit Mike during that day anyway to help with a PC problem. Danny was like an IT specialist and he was good with drives and computers and things. Mike was having a problem with his. And he got there and he started looking at his computer and this photograph came up and it was from the case. And Danny just happened to mention it. He just happened to say, well, oh, what's this? Yeah. You know, there was like the words, you know, poltergeist and, oh, what's going on? Yeah. So Mike told him all about the case. But it was back in the early stage of the investigation when the anonymity thing hadn't sort of been, you know, established. If we were going to write the book, you know what I mean? So there's a few people that do know them. Anyway, to go long story short, Danny had said, oh, where's this happening? And Meg had said, well, oh, there's a place called Lock Street just down such and such, blah, blah, blah. So, and he went, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. He says, no, why? What's up, Lee? He says, well, I drove past Lock Street at 2 o'clock this morning. He says, I was on my way home. I drove past Lock Street. And just as Danny was driving past the street where this family lived, this phone decided to call Mike by itself.
Jeez.
Just as he was driving past. Now, Danny didn't have any sort of contact at all with the family. He didn't even know them. But his only link back to the family was that he knew Mike, who was involved with the family. So again, we talk about this in the book, the you know, like opening a chain, opening like a link of people, how it can spread from people to people. And we've classed this as second stage contagion because Danny wasn't involved in the case at that particular point. He did come in eventually to help with a little bit of the investigation. But at that particular point in time, he had nothing to do with the case. And you say all he did was know Mike. So we class that as second stage contagion, which is quite rare, but it's happened. The first stage contagion is when investigators go to Ground Zero, or the haunted house. They take it away, like we saw the book fly off the shelf. We experienced what we considered ahead to be first stage contagion because we had direct contact with the family in question. Second stage was a little bit further. It's just like you throw a stone in a pond. You know, it seemed, the ripples seem to spread outwards, but as the ripples spread further out, they become weaker. So the more the contagion occurs, the weaker it seems to get. There might be a third stage contagion, which we've talked about, which is extremely rare. But it's something for people to think about. We're trying to like sort of nail a bit of terminology here.
Right.
And see, like, well, look, this, to understand what we're talking about, we need to, like, you know, we'll give you some example. First stage contagion, second stage contagion, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll talk about different parallels and all sorts of stuff. It's fascinating. It really is. Sometimes I read the book myself and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, wow, you know, I look at it, wow, I'm pleased with this. This is going to be potentially good. And I hope people agree with me when they read it. I hope they find it fascinating.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing this and joining us today on the program. Poltergeist Parallels and Contagion is the name of the book. We have a link for that program or for that book on our program guide today. So make sure you get it, read it. It's available on Kindle and paperback. And Darren, keep in touch with us as this progresses and let us know if you run across any other interesting cases you think our audience would be interested to hear about.
Oh, I certainly will. Well, like I say, we had a few after South Shields. But that was a long time ago, and what always got my ears and eyes open, always listening out,
Maybe we'll need to touch base with you in a month or two and visit you about some of the other cases that you've worked on then.
Yeah, by all means. Yeah, by all means. That would be great. Right. But again, they're all written up and detailed in the book anyway. They were short. Although they were short, they were like a couple of week type things, and they weren't sure as long as and intense as this. But they're like sort of tied up in chapters.
Gotcha.
It was still fascinating nonetheless. It was still absolutely fascinating.
So there you go, folks. When you get the book, you get all of this, all of these independent stories we haven't touched on, plus the overview of everything that we've discussed today and more. So check that out for yourself. Darren, thank you again. And thank you to all of our listeners. Make sure that you keep in touch with us at darknessradio.com, darknessevents.com, and go to darknessradio.com. Click on the shop tab. It'll take you in and click the Amazon shop. You'll see all of our paranormal books, true crime books, all of the things we cover and carry on the show. Plus, there's a plethora of awesome paranormal swag and gift items there for you to take a look at with the holidays coming up. Check it out for yourself. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.